always hard to remember, especially when you're reporting, that it's not about you. So I think a lot of reporters go in and don't really listen to the people that they're interviewing because they're waiting for quotes to confirm what they already believe. And so I would say, if you're doing interviewing, if you're doing reporting, to be a sort of more compassionate and open listener and like really hear what people are telling you, because often it'll be the opposite of what you expect, and to like really respect that. I mean, so many times I've written stories where I think I know what I'm gonna find out, and then I am completely wrong.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to episode 9 of the Austin Meyer Podcast, where I welcome the world's best storytellers to come chat about how they think about and how they craft stories. Today's episode is sponsored by my good friends Daniel Leon and Dominique Yavi, who are offering me their couch to sleep on this week while I'm out in New York trying to make some connections with documentary filmmakers. So shout out to Daniel and Dom. I appreciate it. This week on the show, I'm so excited to welcome Annalisa Quinn. Annalisa is a freelance journalist and critic working for some of the world's most reputable publications. She's a contributing writer, reporter, and literary critic for NPR, where she created NPR's book news column and covers literature and culture. And she also writes about arts and culture for the New York Times and the Financial Times, and is a frequent contributor to the New York Times Magazine section called First Words, which includes essays on what language reveals about our current moment in culture and politics. In this conversation, Annalisa and I talk about life as a freelance journalist, the end-to-end process of reviewing books for NPR, how reading hundreds of books has influenced her writing, how stories benefit from posing big questions, and then just in time for the holiday season, what books she recommends for you to get your loved ones. Please enjoy this episode with Annalisa Quinn. All right.
Let's hit record.
Let's do this thing.
Okay.
Annalisa Quinn, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So you are coming to me from your house in Boston right now.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you working on today over there?
Well, I'm reviewing a bunch of books and I'm trying to figure out what looks good for next year. So I'm going to do the thing where I have a big stack and I read the first chapter and see what looks interesting.
What looks good for next year? So you have books that you're going to be reviewing in the next few months, and you have just like a stack of them, or how does it work?
Yeah, it would be great to have a more structured organizational system, but at the moment they are just stacks. I get them in the mail, they pile up in a corner, and then like every couple weeks I'll just sit down and go through the giant stack. And like I was saying to you, like a lot of them are like, you know, how to help your cat lose weight in 10 days or whatever, you know, kind of random things that I wouldn't write about. But it's always fun to see what I got.
If you get a book in the mail that is about how to get your cat to lose weight, who is sending you that? I can't imagine NPR sending you that. Or is it the author who's just like, I saw Annalisa Quinn reviews books for NPR, let me get this to her in hopes?
Yeah, and like her cat looks really chubby, right? No, so it's the publishing companies. So, you know, there are like 5 big publishers, and they publish everything from literary fiction to self-help to, you know, whatever else. And so I think they just kind of send everything.
Okay. And so do you, as someone who reviews books, do you have to like register with them or give them your address? Like, how do they find you?
That's a great question. They just come. I don't know how they find me. I mean, usually what will happen is like there'll be a book I'm reviewing, and so I'll give them my address for that particular book. And then you get on a list, and I don't know. Like everywhere I've ever lived, I get emails being like, how can we make these books stop? Because once you're on the list, you never get off the list. Like my parents get them, our old house in England, my friends, when I've like stayed with them and gotten books there.
Oh my gosh, that's so funny. That totally makes sense, because the last apartment I was at, we were getting mail from the people like years ago that had moved out. And so people at your apartments are just getting loads of books.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I'd love to start our conversation by hearing a little bit about how you got started as a writer. how you got started in this whole journalism world. So maybe you can just start by sharing a little bit of your background.
Sure. So I didn't think I would be a journalist until I was actually a journalist. So when I was in college, I studied classics and English, and I kind of thought I would get a PhD at some point. I thought that's what I would probably want to do. But I had written a few art reviews for the school paper and just loved it. And I entered a few like student writing competitions and you know, I really loved the whole process. And so I applied for an internship at NPR and I got it. And then I started working there right after college on the books desk, which was miraculous. It was so fun. I didn't realize that you could just have a job where you read books and talk about what you think all the time. So then I was kind of hooked.
Where was that at again?
In Washington, D.C. at NPR.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And so I worked for NPR for a while, and then I got my master's in classics, because I still wasn't really sure if I did want to go back and get a PhD after all. So I did a master's in classics in the UK and lived there for a few years. And I've just been freelancing, really, and now I'm in Boston.
So how did that first gig with NPR, how did that happen?
Well, I just applied for the internship. I mean, it's an amazing internship, and I feel really lucky because it didn't used to pay, and so my year was the first year where they started paying, and I never would have applied if they hadn't paid, just on principle, but also you can't live in Washington, D.C. and not get paid, because it's an expensive city. So, yeah, I think I just lucked out. I mean, it was an amazing internship, and I still work with the same people that I worked with then, who are so talented and smart and fun, so.
That's cool. Did you always have a deep love for reading and writing? Did kind of you come to those before one of the other?
For sure. I mean, I find reading much more natural than writing. I think most people do. It's only in the last few years that I've started really enjoying the feeling of writing. Mm-hmm. I think before that, there was like, it was a little bit torturous because, you know, you read books and you want to be able to do what the person in the book is doing. You want to be able to write like that, and you can't, especially at first. So it's frustrating. Mm. But yeah, now I love it.
Yeah. And so when you started freelancing, I'm really interested in just how people in the storytelling world, you know, I have been in the same position for the last couple of years as a freelance videographer, of how people make a living doing it. And how people are making their connections and getting opportunities to write for different publications. So what was that process like for you?
Well, it was really hard at first. And I always think that people don't talk enough about the money aspect of it, because it's really stressful to not know where your money is coming from or when it's coming or if you can make enough to live on. So when I first started freelancing, I was living in London, which is one of the most expensive cities in the world, and it was really terrifying for the first few months. I mean, luckily, I have always written for NPR, and so I have a kind of steady gig with them, so I can kind of count on that. But at first, I didn't know how you pitch a story. I didn't know who to pitch stories to. You know, it seemed completely vast and terrifying. But then, you know, the great thing about freelancing is every year that I've done it, it's gotten better and easier and more fun. And so at a certain point, you start building relationships with publications and with editors. And now you kind of want to get to the place where people are asking you to write things instead of having to go through the process of like pitching constantly, which is, you know, just kind of draining. And so now I feel like I'm lucky because I'm mostly work with NPR and The Times, and I have great editors that I really love and respect at both of those publications. And so it's sort of easier, you know, you kind of say, you can just send an email saying, like, I've been thinking about this, what do you think? Yeah. As opposed to the sort of formal pitching process.
So you just say, I've been interested in this concept, do you think that could make a good piece?
Yeah. I mean, especially at NPR, I'll be like, don't give anybody else this book. I want it. Or, you know, you talk to people and so you build relationships that way. And then they think of you. They know what you're interested in. They think of you when something comes up.
Did you ever, when you were starting out as a freelancer, say you had great connections at NPR, you had relationships there. Could you ever go to NPR and say, like, hey, you know, I need more clients or I need more people to work with. Would you mind putting me in touch with another publication? Or is that kind of like not how things work?
I don't think that would work because they're competitors. And also, I mean, it's, you could ask maybe if you know somebody really well, if you know an editor really well, and you knew that they knew somebody else at a different publication, you could talk to them about it. But I probably wouldn't go about it that way. I mean, I think honestly, if you don't know somebody going in, what you do is you, I mean, most magazines, most news outlets will have a masthead. Mm-hmm. So you figure out who the editor is that you want to talk to. You can usually figure out their email address because usually there's, you know, first name dot last name or something
along those standard.
Line. Right. And then I think cold emailing them, I mean, it's always how I've done it. And I think people always say it's all about connections in journalism. And I'm sure that's true to an extent. But in my experience freelancing, if you write a good pitch and you email it to somebody and you say, here's who I am, here's the work I've done, they're responsive. So that's what I would say.
Cool. In what ways do you think that you have developed most as a storyteller from when you first had that internship with NPR to where you are today?
Well, I think it's really easy to believe that you need permission to do stories that you want to do. Because, you know, especially if you're working for a news outlet, you do literally need permission. But I think if you're a freelancer, you don't have to wait for somebody to want the story. You can just start doing it. And so now I've been doing it for long enough that I don't worry too much about placing a story. If I think it's interesting, I'll just start working on it and I know it will find a home somewhere. Or, you know, if I decide there's nothing in it, that's fine too. But I think not feeling like I have to wait for somebody to tell me, sure, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. And then you also mentioned that the writing process has gotten easier. Have you noticed that you've developed any sort of routine or rituals, practices to make that writing practice easy? Or is it just with the amount of reps you've gotten, the words are starting to just flow out of your head a little bit more fluidly?
I feel like there's like a specific combination of like stress, caffeine, sunlight that kind of makes it happen. You know, like you want to be like a little stressed, but not super stressed. So you actually get it done. But no, I mean, I think the longer you do it, the more you kind of get a sense for what works for you. So like I write best in the mornings, like first/second cup of coffee time is really good. You know, I like working in libraries. And then the other thing is, I think it's easy to forget that, especially if I'm reporting a story, often I'll be in a place where I'm stuck and then I'll remember, oh yeah, I can call people. That's the point of reporting. So I'll like call people, ask what they think, talk it through, and then that will get things started again, even if I don't end up using the quotes in the end.
Yeah, cool. So we started talking about your work doing book reviews for NPR. So I'd love to kind of start there with our conversation to kind of get into some of the details of your work. And I was reading an interview that you did with NPR in preparation for this podcast. And you said in that interview that criticism isn't the same as giving your opinion when you're reviewing books. And so that makes me think of the broadest question, which is what is criticism, or what is book criticism? What do you do?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I wonder that all the time. Well, I guess what I meant when I said criticism isn't the same as giving your opinion is that, I mean, everybody has opinions, right? But I think criticism, it just involves a lot of research. It's actually a lot more like reporting than people think. I mean, you know, you really should spend a lot of time, you know, in an author's back catalog. You really should be reading other things that, you know, are relevant to whatever the topic is. I don't know. I have a really hard time answering the question of what criticism is or what it should do. I mean, I definitely don't feel like my job is giving recommendations. I mean, it's nice. If I really love a book and I convince somebody else to read it, that's nice. But I think usually what I'm trying to do when I write a book review is say, okay, what does this book tell us about the world? Or like, what does it tell us about people? Like, what are the ideas that I can take out of this and apply more broadly rather than this is, you know, 4 out of 5.
What do you think readers come to your work for?
I have no idea. I mean, I know when I read other people's book criticism, usually I read it after I've read the book. So I don't tend to read reviews to figure out if I want to read a book. I tend to read them because I want to know if a book either like struck somebody the same way or if they took away something different from it, something I hadn't thought of, if there was just an aspect of it that I missed. Because obviously, you know, you come to a book with all of your experiences and prejudices and ideas. And so I think that's actually one reason it's really nice that I think book criticism is getting a lot more diverse, because you just, you have people with different lives talking about like what a book, you know, illuminated for them. So
yeah,
that's what I read other people for. I have no idea who reads my work other than my mom and, you know, mean people on the internet.
Well, that's interesting to just think of, you know, the phrase book review. Because I think when I hear the word review, I think about like, I'm going to go on Amazon. I'm interested in buying this thing. You know, let me go look at the reviews to make sure that I'm not getting duped or that this product's actually good. And I don't know what the broader public does when it comes to book reviews, and whether they read yours like that. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably just snobby that I have this knee-jerk reaction against treating books like products, you know, because obviously you should be able to figure out from a review if you actually want to read the book.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. So can you walk me through the whole process and the timeline of a book that you'll review for NPR? So as you mentioned already, you get a bunch of books mailed to your house from the publishers. What happens next?
Well, I try not to rely on that too much, in part because there's so many small presses that put out great stuff, and they just don't have the publicity oomph of, you know, Random House or something. So I guess I start with catalogs. So, you know, I'll start with the Penguin Random House catalogs, but then also there are a bunch of small presses that I love, like Grey Wolf is really good, and I think they're out of Minneapolis? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. But I start with the catalogs. I kind of often I'll see an author that I've been interested in before, or I like previous work, or it just sounds really interesting, and so I'll make a note of that. And then, you know, I'll read a few chapters, see if it's something that I, you know, have something to say about, really. And then usually every couple of weeks I'll send an email to my editor at NPR, Petra, and say, you know, here are 10 things that look good. And she'll say, great, you know, do these ones. Or she'll say, actually, I'd really love it if you could review this thing that's coming out. It's kind of a mix. Like, I come up with maybe half of the titles and she comes up with the other half.
Okay. So what types of things are you looking for or catch your imagination in those first couple chapters to decide this is a book that I want to spend a bunch of time reviewing?
Well, I guess I love feeling surprised. Like, I love, like, I think there are so many generic types of books, you know? So I think often you'll kind of, like, certain kinds of literary fiction are really formulaic, in the same way that, like, some mystery novels can be really formulaic. So if I'm getting into something and I know where it's going, I don't really want to write about it. But you know, if something just has a weird voice, like the, I just read a book I loved called Milkman by Anna Burns, and it's set in Northern Ireland during the Troubles. And it's just really thorny, confusing writing. Like, there was a really mean negative review in the New York Times that I didn't agree with, but I kind of loved, where Dwight Gardner, the reviewer, was like, the reader is left like hunting for longing for verbs the way that like cows long for salt, you know, like salting. And I, you know, that's definitely true, but it was such a weird style of writing, and it was so surprising and so sort of like sneakily intelligent that I just completely fell in love. Yeah.
Even within the first two chapters, you knew that there was something surprising and exciting that you wanted to follow.
I mean, with that book, it was first sentence, you know, it just so surprising and weird, and like it's just a voice that I hadn't come across before. And so like, that's always just really fun. Mm-hmm. And then there are other books that you pick up and you're like, wow, I know from paragraph one that I'm not going to find this interesting. Like, I have to review a lot of political books. And so I recently had to review Bernie Sanders' memoir.
Mm-hmm. I read your review on that.
And I just hated it, and I knew I would hate it, and I tried to get out of it. I was like, please, can I not review this? And they were like, we need to review it. Just suck it up. And I did, and I was just, sometimes you read something, and you're like, the point of this is to be inoffensive. Like, the point of that book was to, like, get him on the talk shows as opposed to, like, say something. So, I don't know. I think it's just very intuitive what is interesting and what isn't.
For the listeners, I have a quote from Annalisa's review on the Bernie Sanders book written down, which I love here, and I'll offer it up right now, which is, quote, why anyone would read one of these, in parentheses, Bernie Sanders books, or political books, when they could be reading a book about good-looking British detectives or ghosts or rockets is beyond me. And that's what I was going to ask after I read that, is like, how you choose. And so, it seems like that might be one that the editors felt like, we need to have something on this because it's going to be a talking point.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of servicey part of it, where you're like, people are interested in this book because people are interested in Bernie Sanders. So, like, part of our job is having an opinion on it. And then, even if I personally was a brat about giving my opinion on it.
Gotcha. In the way that you analyze a book, or even in the way that you choose books, do you think about the level in the interest of, like, the average reader and the broad audience, or do you think about just, like, your personal curiosity? Like, how much, like, obviously you are someone who's extremely well read, and you might be interested in topics and language that the broadest population isn't. So how do you kind of think about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, so I guess in general, I write about what I find interesting, which is selfish in a way. But I think the other thing is that if we just wrote about the books that are already going to be popular, I mean, that seems a little bit besides the point. I mean, I definitely think of part of my job is just being kind of the advance guard, where I just read as much as I can and try to find things that are interesting and new and maybe wouldn't get that kind of critical attention normally. Mm-hmm. And so, especially with these small presses, sometimes you just come across amazing, obscure books. And so I really enjoy the process of, like, trying to get those books into more people's hands. And, you know, often, like, if I am reviewing a book of, like, nature poetry, I just know that not that many people are going to go out and buy this book or care. But, you know, I think that I like the process of being like, okay, kind of saying to the author almost like, I see what you're doing here and I think it's really worthwhile. You know, I think popularity is, like, not always a great measure of quality.
What makes a good book review?
I think, you know, you read a lot of formulaic book reviews. You know, you sort of have the plot summary and you throw in a few adjectives, you know, I don't know. I think it's very easy to treat it like you're just telling somebody whether you thought it was a good book or not. But I think if a book review really sort of takes that step back to say, like, what does this tell us about ourselves or this time we're living in or this place we're living in, then that's what I find interesting. Or, like, you know, if they're picking up, I mean, that kind of, like, sentence level literary analysis is something that I really enjoy. And so if a book is saying, you know, here's how language works in this author's world, that's also really exciting and interesting.
I feel like the times that I've turned to art or literary criticism sometimes is actually when I've disliked something.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I find those moments interesting. Like, I watched this documentary the other last week, which is winning all these critical like acclaim, all these awards. Hale County is in the title. And I watched like 30 minutes and I turned it off and I was just not getting into it. And I was like, wait, hold on. What am I missing here? And I think those are interesting moments to read that. How fast do you read books? Because you review a lot.
Yeah, I think I'm a pretty fast reader. I try to slow down if I'm actually going to write about it. I mean, usually I'll read a book. If I'm reviewing it, I'll try to read it 3 times. So, like, whoa. I read really quickly at first to see if I'm interested. And then if I am, I'll just kind of read at my natural pace, which is, like, I'm not naturally that careful of a reader, I think. So I'll read it quickly first and just get that kind of like emotional impact and experience of like, how did this feel to read? And then I'll go back with a pen and like make notes in margins the same time, just like thinking about how the whole thing is put together and trying to sort of figure that out. And then the third time is more of a skim, kind of going back through, looking at my notes, collecting quotes, that kind of thing.
Gotcha. And so are you at this point reading, you know, maybe one a week, one every couple weeks, one every day? What is it?
maybe one a day, maybe one every 2 days, something
okay.
like that.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. And how has reading so much and reading so many different authors, styles, stories, how has that influenced you as a writer when you're doing columns that aren't about books, that are about language and culture, which we'll get into as well?
Well, there are definitely some writers that if I'm feeling stuck, I will revisit because I'm like, oh yeah, you're allowed to write like that. You know, oh, like Zadie Smith, I think I'm like meh on her novels. I think they're good, but not great, but her criticism is amazing. And so she just came out with this book of essays called Feel Free, which I really loved. And there's this like this essay about dance where she's comparing Prince and Michael Jackson. And it's just so well done. It's so intelligent, but also emotional. And like, it's just this really surprising piece of writing. So I'll often like go back to something like that. And just to kind of like remind myself what really good writing looks like. Or like there's a book of classics essays by a guy named Daniel Mendelsohn. I forget what it's called, but for a while I would return to this one essay about Sappho a lot because I just thought it was so surprising and smart. And so yeah, I think I read for inspiration a lot. Or like Janet Malcolm, she's another amazing writer that I'll read when I'm feeling stuck.
It was interesting to hear you say that often the you fall in love with reading first, or for you and for a lot of people, and then you kind of pick up writing as you go. For me, it was actually the complete opposite.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When I went to Stanford and I had no idea what I wanted to study, I mean, at that point, freshman year coming to college, I was definitely not a reader. I did not enjoy sitting down to read. And,
really?
And I... spring of my freshman year stumbled into this class called English 90, which was a creative writing course around short stories, fiction, and the class absolutely blew me away. It was what ended up putting me on the path to studying English and studying creative writing and then journalism afterwards. So, I credit that class for a lot of like what has happened in my life afterwards. But what I noticed was, once I spent an entire quarter learning the craft of writing, like it totally opened up reading in a new way for me. Cause I was one of those, I was always one of those guys in like English class that was thinking like, okay, there's no way the reader meant like that to do that when we're like overanalyzing things.
Right. And like Hamlet was not a Marxist, or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Then once I started writing and kind of crafting my own stories and thinking so deeply about every little detail, when I went back to read, I was like, oh my gosh, this is magic. and I completely kind of changed my perspective on reading. So I was really interested to hear a little bit about that interplay for you.
For the class, what was it that changed your relationship to reading? Was it the particular books or something about the professor?
I think the whole class was just a great experience for me. To like think that deeply about story in a creative context. I mean, that was really the first class that I took where I was actually doing any sort of writing that was creative. Like in high school, it was just, you know, 5-paragraph analytical essays. Mm-hmm. And I think through writing my own story, first I gained a huge appreciation of the magic of taking something from your imagination and then like bringing it to life on the page. I mean, it's so hard. And yeah. So I just had an appreciation in the same way that like when I learned to play mandolin, I have a whole new appreciation for listening to someone play the mandolin. And then everything from just like how stories are structured to, you know, I just started reading stories as a writer and thinking about how things were working instead of just like glazing over it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're also doing a lot of work with the New York Times, and a lot of your essays with the New York Times are coming out in this particular section called First Words, which looks at language and what it reveals about a current moment in time. So for example, for the listeners, a couple titles of Annalisa's essays. Her most recent one, I believe, is called Everyone Wants to Influence You. That was for the New York Times Magazine. And then another one that I really loved from earlier this year was How Did Witch Hunt Become the Complaint of the Powerful? So looking at a word in those two instances, influence and witch hunt, and kind of looking at the etymology, deconstructing it. And I wonder, Annalisa, how you got interested in that and why that content is ripe for a good story or a good essay.
Sure. Well, I think it was a big moment for me when I realized that you could use the tools of literary analysis in like the world of politics. I remember I was assigned a review of Ivanka Trump's book. And at first I was like, do not make me review this book. This is not even a book. Like, come on. And then I started reading it and I was like, you know what? Actually, like, there's a lot that's really revealing here about her worldview and like the world she grew up in. And it was really satisfying to use the skills that I have as a book critic to sort of take apart that ideology that she maybe unconsciously has. And so I think, especially since the 2016 election, it feels like politics is everywhere, and it feels like it's all I can think about in a way. Like, it's just, it's really consuming. And so, especially with this First Words column, I'm sort of trying to take, you know, close reading and literary analysis into the world of politics. And it works really well. I mean, you know, you can really, you can learn a lot about somebody's values from the kinds of language that they use. And so influence was a really fun one for me because just reading about the history of the word was fascinating. So influence, it comes from a Latin verb, which means to flow in. And in the Middle Ages, it was used of planets, like pouring down influence. But it was also really interesting to read the way that the verb was used in the classical period, which was mostly around religion. And so, like, God or the Holy Spirit would be, like, poured into people. And, like, that's how influence worked. Like, it would flow into you. And it was, like, this amazing image of God almost as, like, a liquid. And then, you know, the sort of ways that we think about influence now, which is much more social and intimate and peer-to-peer, and like, you know, marketers are really leaning into that. So, you know, sort of the influencer marketing is people who kind of are pretending to be normal people, basically, and advertising products. And the Russian hackers, the ways that they tried to spread their views was, again, by pretending to be normal people. So for me, it looked like a big shift in the way that we think about influence from this, like, divine or planetary, or even, you know, in the 20th century, you think about propaganda and, like, big advertising campaigns, very much top-down. And now there's this push to act like it's sort of bottom up and spontaneous, even though in fact, you know, the same powers are still sort of pulling the strings.
How did you come up with the idea for that piece?
Well, so Louis, who you know,
my friend from high school and before, and everybody, yep.
Right. Was reading a book by C.S. Lewis, where he talks about medieval ideas about the planets. And he was just telling me about it, and I'm like, that's fascinating. And I read the chapter where he talks about how in the Middle Ages, people thought that the planets not controlled their behavior, but like inclined you to act in particular ways. I mean, it's not that different from like modern sort of astrology that you see in magazines, this idea that the planets sort of incline you to certain actions or beliefs, but they don't explicitly cause it. And I found that interesting because it seemed like the question there is about free will, you know? So to what extent, what does influence have to say about whether or not we have free will? And so with the planets, there's a sense that you can actually resist these influences. It's really hard, and you have to have this real strength of character to resist these influences, but it's possible because we do have free will. And so I just, that really got me thinking about how propaganda and influence campaigns today, like how we are so anxious about that, and whether that anxiety about whether we're being sort of like controlled by Russians or whatever really goes back to this question of free will and our fear that we don't have it.
Yeah, so cool. And then was it similar with the column that you did about the witch hunt becoming the complaint of the powerful? Is this, you know, you heard of this phrase or this word just coming up again and again in this all-encompassing political world we're in right now? And what did you know about that word or that phrase beforehand that made you think, I think we need to go deeper on the meaning behind this and how it's changed over time?
So that one actually was not my idea. So I was living in London at the time, and I had just started a job at the Financial Times, and I was starting like that Monday, and I got an email from Charlie Homans, who's the politics editor at the magazine, saying, hey, you know, I've been reading your book reviews, like, are you interested in contributing to this column? And I was like, you know, I love the New York Times Magazine, so I was like, oh my God, yes, you know, anytime, anywhere, just tell me what to do. And so I pitched him a bunch of ideas, and, you know, we were kind of going back and forth on them. And then Trump said something about witch hunts, and he came back to me, and he was like, okay, we're going to do witch hunt, and you have a week. And I was like, no. So I was starting this new job on Monday, and I had a week to write this essay for, like, this magazine that I had, you know, always kind of hero worshipped. So it was terrifying. So I would go to work, and then I'd come home, and I would just stay up all night reading about witch hunts, which is not, I mean, it's fascinating, but it's not something I knew anything about. So it was just this terrible but really fun week.
And what resources are you using to do that research?
Yeah, so that was actually a tough one because so with this influence piece, I am in Boston and can use the Harvard Library, which is an incredible library. They have everything. But for the witch hunt one, I was at work during the day, and so I couldn't, I mean, normally I would go to the British Library. So I had one day where I could go to the British Library and go through all of their newspaper archives, which are really good. They have, you know, newspapers going back hundreds of years. So I, you know, like search through those looking for mentions of witch hunts. And then at night when I was doing this research, I was just buying books online and reading them as fast as I could and just trying to, yeah, just unpack the history of this word and like also the sort of the emotional resonance now. And it was really fun. Like I love doing that kind of research where you can think about all of the, you know, the different context people were in when they used the word. Like I really loved, I was going through all the like New York Times archives for when people talked about witch hunts in the press. And there was this period in the 50s where like food regulation, like people were always complaining that like basic food and like hygiene regulation around restaurants was like a witch hunt. So like somebody would have like bugs in their restaurant and be shut down by the government. And they'd be like, this is a witch hunt. my favorite fact was that Arthur Rubin, who invented the Rubin sandwich, got like shut down by health inspectors, and he was like, this is a witch hunt, you know. So it just proliferated to such an extent, especially after the sort of like era of McCarthyism, where it meant like kind of crazy government regulation that's like Soviet style, that it just got into every part of life. And so, you know, it's fun to do that kind of research.
How do you think, or in what ways do you think your writing as a literary critic and your writing for outlets like the New York Times Magazine and these First Word columns, in what ways do those overlap?
Yeah, well, it's very similar, really, because what you're doing is you're doing just deep reading on something. You're just doing really careful word-by-word analysis. So I think that those go together really well. And I think when I'm doing reporting is when it feels somewhat different. Although, in a way, I think being a critic has definitely made me a better reporter, because what you're doing as a critic is you're saying, okay, there's a piece of work, like, what are the questions here? Like, what questions is this book answering? Like, what does this tell us about the world more broadly? And I think that's the same with any issue that you're writing about, is you have to go in with those questions. Like, this happened, you know, X happened. Why is it interesting? Why does it matter? Why should we care? So you go in with the same sort of animating set of questions, but then I think your methods are different. I mean, the great thing about reporting is you do not have to come up with the answers yourself. You just get to call, you know, people who know more than you and ask them and then quote them, which is really fun and a nice change. Whereas with criticism, obviously, you know, you kind of have to come up with the answers yourself.
So if we were going to kind of flip that around as a tactic that we can think about as storytellers for telling good stories, whether that's in writing or making movies or through art, I'm hearing something from you about like the questions you're asking through the stories that you're telling, and whether something in those stories, specific details, can shine a light on something bigger. I'm just kind of thinking that out. Maybe you can help me kind of bring words to that.
Sure. So, I mean, I guess when I think about a story that I'm reporting, I'll give you an example. So I did a story earlier this fall about illegal radio stations in London.
Oh, yeah.
So for a really long time, there's been this culture of creating these kind of like bootleg radio stations and then hijacking the FM dial and like putting out your music. And for a long time, this was really the only way that Black British people got to be on the radio. So it's just this amazing cultural legacy of people who had, you know, music and culture and language that they wanted to hear on the radio and couldn't, and so they did it themselves. So it's an amazing story. But in the last few years, the internet has really changed that, and London has also really changed. So it used to be that, you know, you could be a poor person living in London and you could make your own radio station and you could put it out and your friends would listen to it and the people on your street would listen to it. And, you know, that's how whole genres of music got invented. Like, grime music came out of illegal radio stations in East and South London in the 90s and early 2000s, which is just amazing. But the internet has really changed that. But then also austerity in Britain has really taken away things like social housing and like community centers and places where people go to make culture if they're not rich. So my animating question for that story is, okay, in a London that is very diverse, but also very closed in certain ways, and also really hard to live in if you don't have money, and you're a talented young person from maybe a marginalized community, how do you make culture? Where do you go? Like, where, what places are there for you if you are, so Dizzy Rascal, for instance, was 16 when he, you know, became famous on pirate radio stations in London. Could that happen today? I don't know. You know, because there just aren't the same structures in place to help people that there used to be. So my question is, yeah, like, if you're a young person, how do you make culture? And so that's the sort of big picture question. And then for the specific story, you know, I just talked to a bunch of really interesting, like, mostly teenage rappers who are figuring out how to make music when there aren't that many paths to do it.
Very interesting.
And so you kind of, you start with the big question and then you get into the particulars. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the answer had a lot to do with the internet and different things. But I think you always have to have that big animating question, even if it's implicit, you know, it doesn't have it. You know, I don't think it was explicit in that story, but that's kind of the implicit.
And so when you're posing those questions, how do you decide whether to answer them for your reader or to leave them ambiguous or kind of trailing off into the distance to beg your reader, hey, now this is for you to think about?
Well, it depends if I think I know the answer or not, really. Often I don't know the answer. So with this influence piece, do we have free will? I don't know. I think probably the answer is to an extent. And so I didn't answer that question explicitly, and I did leave it open-ended because I don't think I can give a concrete answer. Whereas with the radio piece, I think there were some really specific answers. How do young people without means make culture? And the answer is often they don't, and sometimes they use the internet, you know? So yeah. I
fair.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I also wanted to touch on in our last little bit here. When I read your columns, one of the things that stands out to me is how strong your first paragraphs are, or like how interesting, yeah, like just how you start your stories and how you end them. And it was funny hearing you talk about the way you read books when people send them to your house is like you flip through the first chapters and it's like it better grab you. And to me, like your introductions really grab me. And then your endings kind of like wrap the bow on it. And so I wanted to read for the listeners the kind of like introductory paragraph to the piece on influence in New York Times Magazine. And then maybe we can talk a little bit about how you, or like why you thought to start your piece here. Okay, so here it goes. There are two contradictory truisms about people under the influence of alcohol. One is that, intoxicated, they become their real selves, mean or weepy, loving or angry, violent or desperate. According to the Roman historian, how do I pronounce it? Tacitus. Ancient Germanic tribes would hold wartime negotiations drunk, reasoning that it made all parties incapable of hiding anything. But the other thing we like to say about drunks, often while shepherding someone apologetically out of a party or a bar, is that he's not himself, or this isn't like her. So which is it? Are we always ourselves, or are we selves tenuous? Or are ourselves tenuous, warped by company and context? Influence suggests some alchemy between the two, between an internal self and an outside pressure, and makes no claims about which is stronger. Power is overtly coercive, but influence is wily. It can slip into your consciousness without your noticing and start renovating. And then it goes into last year, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, and kind of goes into talking about Russian influence in the American elections. And besides the beautiful writing, I just think that's a really interesting place to start with, like, you know, a drunk person being carried out of the bar, mixing that with, you know, Germanic tribes and stuff. And so how did you decide to start your essay on influence with that kind of example? And what are you trying to do there?
Well, I guess the way I started thinking about influence was like as something explicitly liquid, because that's what the sort of origins of the word are in. It's about flowing. And I think it's really, I think often we use words in ways that kind of reflect their etymology or history, but don't realize that we're doing it. And so I think alcohol is a really good way of thinking about influence, because it's this substance that kind of flows into you. Like, I mean, they used to talk about the Holy Spirit, like spirit as an alcohol, right? Kind of inspiring you or changing you. And like, there's this amazing part in the Bible, which I tried to put in this, but I don't remember if it made it in, but basically where a bunch of people are possessed by the Holy Spirit and somebody says, are they drunk? And I think Paul says, no, or maybe it's Jesus says no, you know, they're, the Holy Spirit has poured into them. And so I think we've always used alcohol as a way of thinking about that kind of like religious or like divine inspiration. And then also just in my own life, when I've like, when I know people who have like substance abuse problems, that's a question you always have. It's like, is this really what they're like? Or like, are they being changed? I mean, this is something I think about a lot with addiction. Like, to what extent do people, like, to what extent do substances make people more or less like themselves? You know, and like, mm-hmm. when people say, oh, it's the alcohol speaking or it's the whatever speaking, is that true? Or like, does it just lower your inhibitions and make you less apologetic about who you really are? And so that's just a question I have in life.
Yeah.
And I think because everybody knows somebody with either an alcohol problem or like who becomes a very specific way under the influence, it seemed like a good way of introducing this concept of Russian influence. Because, you know, like we've been reading endlessly about Russian influence
endlessly.
And it's very technical and depressing. And kind of hard to imagine, like, are we just imagining these, like, Russian guys in a basement somewhere at their laptop pretending to be Americans? Like, it's just, it's hard to kind of get into from that angle. Mm-hmm. And I think since alcohol is so recognizable and universal, and also just, I think, a good metaphor for how influence works generally.
Yeah.
That's why I wanted to start there. And then the Tacitus quote, I came across really randomly. I don't even remember where. And that seemed funny to me, that idea that there's a whole, and you know, who knows if this is actually true, but his idea that there was a whole society of people who were like, well, the only way to make sure that we don't lie to each other is to get hammered before our like diplomatic negotiations, you know?
Yeah. I think for me as an introduction, what I look for as a storyteller and what I feel reading that introduction is one, there's something familiar and relatable to it. In that we've all either been in the situation or know people who have been in the influence of alcohol. So that's relatable. There's something surprising in it to even, see that come up against some of these, like historical elements in the introduction. And we know we're going to go kind of deep into this one word. And then also in this example, you're literally posing a question. You say, are we always ourselves or are ourselves tenuous, warped by company in context? And I think a lot of great stories, like we've talked about, they pose these questions a lot of times up top in the story. And those questions can be explicit in this case, or they can be implied. And for me as a reader, having that question up top is really makes me curious to find out the answer. And then we kind of come back to the ending of this piece, which I'll also read the last paragraph of the piece. And you can see, listeners, how Annalisa wrapped this up and see where we came to after the analysis within the article about that question. We like to think of our characters as fixed. We have our beliefs and our morals, religions and parties, states and countries, friends and enemies. We are inevitably ourselves, inescapably ourselves. We should be able to resist this kind of manipulation. But a steady stream of social science studies suggests otherwise, demonstrating again and again how easily social pressures can affect the way the things we say, believe, do, think, eat. Our anxiety over influence comes back to the same fear Thomas Aquinas, am I saying that right? Aquinas had the same doubt families of alcoholics or cult members have. In the face of powerful influences, how can you locate and hold onto that original, irrefutable spark of self, your free will, your character, even your soul? That's the fear that the idea of influence lays bare, that you can't, or that it might never have existed in the first place. So do you want to speak, Annalisa, to where you arrived and how you ended that piece and why you chose that?
Well, first I want to say I'm really impressed by the fact that you managed to say a steady stream of social science studies. I can't believe I wrote that. That's hilarious. Anyways, well done.
Thank you.
So how did I come to that conclusion? I don't know. I mean, I guess I think often writing a piece, I have a question and I'm trying to figure it out. And like, that's kind of, I think my real question, I mean, so obviously the sort of big question is like, do we have free will and how do we know if we don't? Mm-hmm. But this sort of tangential question is, why are we so upset by this idea of Russian influence when, I mean, so I talk about a book that I really liked in this piece called Network Propaganda, and it's about how we really think that, you know, we're being sort of manipulated by trolls and bots and Russians and hackers and the Chinese, and like, you know, all of these people are like, you know, brainwashing us. But in reality, like, the people that actually spread a lot of the propaganda and like the lies that, you know, helped elect Donald Trump, so the, you know, Pizzagate stuff, you know, the stuff about Hillary Clinton's emails, like stuff that was just fundamentally misleading, they were not Russians. It was, you know, the right-wing American media. And like, that's not to say that there aren't also, you know, people who spread disinformation on the left, like somebody like Rachel Maddow. Like, she is, you know, hugely guilty of being misleading. But she's not as influential as somebody like Sean Hannity. So like, Sean Hannity helped spread these conspiracy theories, not by saying, yes, Hillary Clinton is like trafficking children out of a pizza place, but by saying, people are saying that Hillary Clinton is doing this. Questions have been raised, you know, so, and he's just so obvious about it. So like, we're just not as worried about Sean Hannity as we are about Russians, but really we should be worried about people like Sean Hannity who are hugely influential, just not as sinister seeming because they're so familiar. And so really what I kind of came down to is, okay, the Russians actually probably did not have that much of an effect on the election, on the outcome, aside from the original hack of, you know, of the DNC. So that had an impact. But their actual messaging, when they were pretending to be people on Facebook, does not seem to have had a huge impact. But we care about it disproportionately, and it's because we're afraid of like foreign powers manipulating us. And that's an old fear that goes back in part to the Soviet Union, when we thought the Soviets were brainwashing their people and also us. But that question of like, why are we so worried about that? That's kind of, I think, where I ended up coming down, because the answer to the Russia influence question was, to what extent are they influencing us? Not that much, you know, not much. So why do we care, you know?
Yeah, it's almost like you started with one question, and through your analysis, you don't have like the definitive answer, but you've kind of arrived at a new question a little bit. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
I like it.
Pretty well, sorry.
All right, so we're just about out of time, and I want to wrap up with a few quick questions. Some of these are specifically for this time of year when we're around the holiday period, where I'm sure you get a lot of you have a lot of great book recommendations from all the reading you do. And so a few of these questions I'll run through to end today's podcast. So the first is, what, just over time, not just this year, what is the book that you have gifted the most to people in your life?
Good question. I will often give people Daphne du Maurier novels because they're so good. So she's a suspense writer, I guess, writing in the 20s and 30s, mostly set around Cornwall. So there's Rebecca and My Cousin Rachel, and they're just incredibly atmospheric and like moody and sinister, and they really... She does suspense better than almost anybody. Like, these are books that are just really hard to stop reading, but then it's not like a lot of mysteries where you find out the answer and you never want to read it again, because they're so well done and they're so psychologically astute, and they're so good at creating mood. So not just sort of this atmosphere of like Cornwall with the cliffs and the boats and everything, but also of like fear and how paranoia can kind of take over your life. And so I definitely give people a lot of Daphne du Maurier books.
Cool.
And then one book that I think about a lot is Grief is the Thing with Feathers by Max John Porter, which is, he's a British writer, and it came out a couple of years ago, and it's this is like very small, very odd book about mourning, and it's fiction. But the sort of premise is that this guy's wife died, and it's like his process of grief, and it's like so beautifully done that I think that's my go-to if like somebody is in mourning or experiencing grief of some kind.
Amazing recommendations. Thank you. All right. Next one is, what is a book from 2018 that you recommend people should get for a loved one this holiday season?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So it really depends on the person. So like personally, a book, my favorite book this year, I think, is Milkman by Anna Burns, the one I was telling you about that many people have hated. In fact, my editor, when she was like, she sort of sends it out to the homepage editors and stuff saying, like, this is what's coming next. And normally there'll be, like, a little tagline, you know, like, gripping novel, blah, 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 blah. But I think she wrote something like, looks impenetrable or something like that. And, like, that's definitely been what a lot of people have said. But I just, I found it stunning. Like, I kept sitting on the couch and I would, like, gasp aloud at people in my house, be like, what is wrong with you? So I love that. I love the way, you know, it's about the troubles in Northern Ireland, but it's not really a political book. It's about how fear in communities can, like, make communities destroy each other. So one thing that she did really well is she never talks about the British, or she never talks about, so it's set in the context of this sort of Catholic community in Northern Ireland. And so there are, she calls them the enemy. It's over the water, as in the British, or over the road, as in the Protestants or the Loyalists. But you never see any of them, really. And it's mostly just about the idea of them and the effect that this has on this very insular community that kind of, it's constantly worrying about informers and spies and traitors and the ways that, like, the community just completely tears itself apart. So it's just a very psychologically astute novel. That was a long answer.
All right. Milkman.
Yeah.
Check it out, everybody.
And with the caveat that lots of people found it boring.
With that caveat. And if you do check it out, please let Annalisa know. We're going to get her her social media accounts in just a minute. The next question. So with New Year's resolutions around the corner, I know it's pretty common for people to have a resolution around reading more books. I feel like that's pretty common. So what is some advice that you have to people who want to become better readers?
Yeah. Well, I think reading things that you don't know if you'll like them. I mean, I think it's very easy to get stuck in your reading habits and not read books by different kinds of people in particular. Because I think, I mean, the publishing industry is very, they're really high barriers to entry, which means a lot of people who should be read aren't read. So I think maybe thinking outside of your usual books, and then I guess making time in your life where you're not looking at your phone or laptop. I personally struggle with that a lot. But you know, there are like all these studies that show even having your phone like in view makes you a less attentive conversationalist, or you know, worse at whatever it is you're doing. So I think like leaving your, you know, your phone and your laptop in a different room when you're reading, and letting your, like, giving yourself permission to be fully absorbed, I think is a really valuable thing.
Great advice. And for people who want to kind of break those reading habits and look for things that maybe are a little outside the, that typical catalog or whatever it is, where do people find resources to figure out which books they should check out?
Like, what do you look
at? I mean, theoretically, that's like part of the job of being of critics is like, you know, trying to find that kind of stuff. And like, obviously, sometimes we don't do a great job of that. And so, you know, you can definitely look at like the smaller presses. Like I mentioned Grey Wolf, I think they just put out amazing work. But then, you know, I think there are a lot of critics whose taste I just think is wonderful, like Parul Segal at the New York Times Book Review. I mean, I will read anything she tells me to read. And then one book, you know, if people want to read things outside of their normal range, is a memoir that I just read called Heavy, and it's about racism and like weight and like addiction in the South, and it's a memoir, and it completely blew me away. So that's another recommendation.
So before I ask my last question, Annalisa, where can people go to follow you, to read your work, and reach out to you if they have more questions or want to learn more?
Well, you can look for me on NPR, so you can search my name, or at the New York Times, or on Twitter, although I'm not particularly active. It's Annalisa_Quinn.
Annalisa Quinn, and that's, do you want to spell that for everybody?
Annalisa Quinn.
Boom. Did I get that okay. Right? Yep, you got it right. Last question for you on the podcast today. So based on all the books you read, the stories you write, where, you know, you have this great balance of weaving history with the current moment to kind of show us something new. Based on all your experience in your career so far, I'm wondering what advice do you have for us listening about how we can tell better stories?
Well, I think it's always hard to remember, especially when you're reporting, that it's not about you. So I think a lot of reporters go in and don't really listen to the people that they're interviewing because they're waiting for quotes to confirm what they already believe. And so I would say if you're doing interviewing, or if you're doing reporting, to be a sort of more compassionate an open listener and like really hear what people are telling you, because often it will be the opposite of what you expect, and to like really respect that. I mean, so many times I've written stories where I think I know what I'm going to find out, and then I am completely wrong.
Fantastic advice. Annalisa, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer podcast. This was super fun.
Yeah, it was.
That's it for episode 9 of the Austin Meyer podcast. Thank you so much to Annalisa for sharing her wisdom, and to you for taking the time to listen. If you get the chance, I'd be so grateful if you could go rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. Apple Podcasts just came out with their list of the year's top podcast, and surprisingly, we at the Austin Meyer podcast were not on the list, but that won't stop us. We're still going. We're going to make that list one day, so every rate and review helps. Also, we're 9 episodes in, and I would love to hear what you think of the show. So hit me up at Austin Meyer Films on Instagram and Facebook, or at A Meyer Films on Twitter, to let me know what you are enjoying and what you want to hear more of. I will see you next week on episode 10, the double-digit episode. Until then, go out and tell some stories.